What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Damage Report without John Iadarola. I am, you know, the evil step mommy dragon. I forgot what I was, but I'm taking care of y'all today. I'm Francesca Fiorentini, joined on a Thursday by the wonderful Brett Ehrlich. Brett, Merry Christmas Eve.
I see a lot of people not just calling me Brad, but also Bert in the chat, and it hurts. They're also blaming me for things that are probably my fault, but I still don't like it. Okay. But I'm happy to be here. It's Thirsty Thursdays, and I promise to be extra thirsty on this fantastic occasion. So there's that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got the fireplace going. It's all very, I don't know. I feel like there's mistletoe pretty much like covering your entire roof. And you're like, well, it looks like we're standing under it again.
Yeah, wife still refuses to engage in any sexual activity with me, but that's her right. That's her prerogative. We have separate rooms, separate
Thirsty
lives.
Thursday, starting out real thirsty, almost desperate if you ask me. But we still have news. Isn't that insane and unfair that around the holidays, you know, that Santa Claus would not also just steal all the prompters, teleprompters from the world, or I don't know, because once all the teleprompters are gone, there's no more news. That's how it works, right?
We have no excuse here at TYT, the prompter free network. That's why we're forced to cover stuff. If we were like every other news network and just crutched it on prompters, as God intended, by the way,
as
a longtime promptery in my former life.
Oh, I'm a huge promptery. I'm like, once you learn promptee, you know, prompties, you just like, you love it. So like coming into the TYT studio was like, no, what? Huh? Okay. I feel like if TYT were right wingers, like Trump would have just been, you know, they use no prompters. Pretty amazing. Right? They would love you guys for it. I mean, us.
We family, mishpoch.
Thank you guys for being here. If you haven't already, hit that like button, y'all. Share the stream right now. It is the holidays. Maybe you're with family and friends, hopefully safe. Maybe your plans got canceled. That's okay. Plenty of Christmas movies and non-Christmas movies, debatably Christmas movies to go around. So thank you so much for joining us. We got a lot to get to. I don't know. Should we just do it? Let's get into it.
Yeah, let's get into it.
Any other, I think I have another announcements, but I will do them in a little bit. Actually, just quick reminder, this is our last show until next Tuesday, the 28th. But you can like TYT.com, YouTube/TYT, like you can, all the shows you missed, everything you missed, because I know you've missed stuff. Don't keep on wanting to do, get new, more new. You haven't seen all the conversation. Have you? So TYT.com, make sure that you watch all that content while we are gone. But let's get into our first story. This is a real Christmas one. You know, it's been almost a year since the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th by a mob of MAGA and militias. And every day, it seems like we learn more and more about how close we were to an actual coup, an American coup. Ironically, inside America. So I guess that's progress. I don't know. But according to two authors of a new piece in Just Security, which is a national security publication, who pieced together all the testimonies from former officials, as well as many different books that have come out since January 6th, we learned that actually there is a reason that the National Guard was not called to January 6th, which I think has been the biggest question mark for a lot of us. We're like, why weren't there more police? Why wasn't there the National Guard? Why were Capitol Police officers and DC Metropolitan Police officers left to their own devices? Turns out there might be a very good reason. So the Pentagon's restraint in allowing the Guard to get to the Capitol was not simply a reflection of officials' misgivings about the deployment of military force during the summer of 2020. Remember, Black Lives Matter and all that, where Trump wanted to call out the National Guard. Nor was it simply a concern about optics of having military personnel at the Capitol. Instead, evidence is mounting that the most senior defense officials did not want to send troops to the Capitol because they harbored concerns that President Donald Trump might utilize the force's presence in attempt to hold power. Right. So basically, we're talking about one guy in particular. There were a couple of them. But one guy in particular, Christopher Miller, who served as acting Secretary of Defense on January 6th, told the department's inspector general that he feared, quote, if we put US military personnel on the Capitol, I would have created the greatest constitutional crisis probably since the Civil War. In congressional testimony, he said he was also cognizant of the fears that the president would invoke the Insurrection Act to politicize the military in an anti-democratic manner. And that factored into my decision regarding the appropriate and limited use of our armed forces to support civilian law enforcement during the Electoral College certification. In other words, I basically didn't want to send people who I thought could make it worse and who the president could directly employ. Unlike the DC Metropolitan Police, Trump would have control over the National Guard and could have used them to bolster the actions of the insurrectionists on January 6th. This is now becoming part of this like grand theory, this thesis. Brad, what do you think of that? That thesis?
It is okay. There's a lot of moving parts and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of specific facts that when you come across them, you realize just how potentially like tenuously we're holding on to like an America that people the world over have grown to rely on, except for those South American countries that Francesca was referring to where we stage coups. Okay, aside from that, but on the world stage, when you think of America as like whether or not a coup would take place, you don't have to worry about it at all. Because and that especially comes from the people who are in Washington. Traditionally, there have been basically all of them look at the American Constitution and the way that power is peacefully passed from one presidency to another. And it really is a fantastic, like reliable system. Mm-hmm. But Trump and that the kind of cynicism and cynicism of our institutions that I think the founders set aside as like a healthy thing to do, where, you know, and created a lot of channels by which theoretically at least you could express your discontent for the system as it was and affect change in it. That's a good cynicism to have. You're supposed to express it through those channels. But Trump has kicked, essentially questioned so many of those norms. And some of the norms that we had were bad and some of them were good. I would argue that the peaceful transfer of power in America is a great norm for us to have. But by emboldening all these people and also kind of moving the discourse toward like Facebook and YouTube chat and all these online forums.
No offense.
Now you just don't know who the bad guys are. We've come a long time since back then where like the bad guys were in red coats. And now you don't know if they're on your side of the military, which by the way, the National Guard influenced greatly by Mike Flynn's brother, who is an avid QAnoner and a guy who, you know, has a chip on his shoulder because he got ousted from the Trump administration early on. Mm-hmm. Like these are the issues that really led to that uncertainty, which is bad in all kinds of ways. And the more we see people piece parts of it together, the more terrifying it is. And the more I don't know what the proper solution is because, you know, and I'm in a position where I have to look at the generals and say, hey, generals, please keep it together when they're the ones who tear other countries apart. And I don't want a military, you know, the generals are still the military and military does coup stuff.
Right.
And it's tough to sort through.
Well, yeah, and it looks like not just Secretary of Defense Christopher Miller, who was promoted after November, after Trump lost, he ousted his Secretary of Defense Esper and promoted Christopher Miller because he thought Miller would be more loyal to him. It turns out that was not the case. And another guy, as Brett is saying, a General Milley, who I think we've heard a lot about, actually feared that January 6th was going to be Trump's Reichstag moment. So according to multiple reports, Milley feared it was Trump's Reichstag moment in which, like Adolf Hitler in 1933, he would manufacture a crisis in order to swoop in and rescue the nation from it. Now, Milley was behind the scenes talking to unsavory people that we didn't have any faith in before, like Mike Pompeo, right? Or Gina Haspel, CIA director. These are people who were on board with the Trump administration and Trump plan from jump. You know, they're like, yeah, we love locking up kids. We love increasing weapon sales to Saudi Arabia. Oh, we love them disappearing American journalists. Done. But this was a bridge too far, not agreeing to a peaceful transfer of power. And like, you know, we talk about the Insurrection Act. So there was evidence, lots of evidence, that Trump was about to invoke the Insurrection Act. He wanted to do so in 2020 during the Black Lives Matter uprising. So on June 1st, the White House aides reportedly went so far as to draft a proclamation to invoke the Insurrection Act of 1807, which allows the president to employ military forces to suppress major civil unrest. And then later on, and Brett referenced this a little bit earlier, but General Flynn was out in front along with a lot of other QAnon crazies, basically saying, yeah, we should do the Insurrection Act, but on January 6th. And in this case, in support of rioters. So by late December, Trump has already lost. Trump's own interest in invoking martial law was widely known. CNN reported on escalating concerns at a heated Oval Office meeting on Friday, December 18th, in which Trump heard arguments about invoking martial law to stay in office, had some Trump officials sounding the alarm to the press, noting that Michael Flynn, Trump's pardoned former national security advisor, discussed the martial law plan on right-wing television network Newsmax last week and was invited to the White House Friday. According to the New York Times, it was Trump who asked about the idea during the meeting. And again, MyPillow man, you know, like Mike Lindell's out there like, oh, what about my plan? Like they all had their own like versions of just do the Insurrection Act, take control of the military. So this wasn't just a, hey, maybe, I don't know, he's not gonna go that far. No. He was absolutely planning on doing this to the point where the Secretary of Defense was like, I don't wanna give him more people at his disposal. Do you think we saved lives, Brett, by doing that? Or, I mean, we know 5 people did die. There was already violence. It's tough to imagine that it was like, at that point, folks were just like, you know what? Let's just let them get their yayas out and hope they don't come across like any lawmakers.
Yeah, I mean, I would have preferred a situation where the demonstrators stayed demonstrators and weren't rioters. And to have folks at the forefront of, at the front, essentially keeping them out of the Capitol building, that would have been ideal. Yeah. But when you look through it, I mean, there's an op-ed in the Washington Post where it says three generals are warning of just how close to a coup we are, because you don't know what members of the military and whose side they're gonna come down on. But a lot of them skew Trump, which is terrifying. And I will say it now, is anti-American. It's scary when we look at who we have to rely on. We're relying on Mike Pompeo. We're relying on General Milley. We're relying on people that, you know, I would say folks on that are closer to me on the political spectrum are skeptical of by and large. And at the very least, we all look around and you see all these crazy politicians that just want power, but to the extent it makes them feel cool, versus Donald Trump, who just wants power pure and simple and doesn't care what he, you know, he's like this monster that all he cares about is power, and he does not care about the things he needs to crush on the way there and how cynically he needs to wield people's cynicism in order to destroy things that I would argue are good for America. And so when he says make America great again, that there was never a time in America where the things he's advocating for, like critical race theory aside, these weird initiatives to say no, you know, all these horrible cynical things. There was never a design for America to do what Donald Trump plans to do. Mm-hmm. And that's horrifying.
It's horrifying. And it's also like the other side has completely politicized this and calling Milley like the deep state. Like top military brass is the deep state? I'm sorry, no. They work for you. They're trying to keep general order in the country so we have a country.
And meanwhile, you got Steve Bannon, going out and talking about shock troops and planning to essentially, he is saying he wants to create a deep state. Like when you listen to Bannon's podcast, he says, all right, we're going to have 4,000 people that I put together. And those people, we're not going to tell you who they are and what their names are, but they have vowed secretly to forward, you know, in all, use any power and tricks at their disposal to eliminate what makes America great, is my take on it. But on him, to eliminate all this, all the things that are standing in the way of us white people taking over America and protecting our ownership of all stuff. And it's terrifying.
Yeah, he hears Reichstag moment and he's like, oh yeah, hell yeah, I want my Reichstag moment. What? Oh, is that bad? No.
He's using terms that the Reichstaggers used in like step two after the fake constitutional crisis, for lack of a better term. And that crisis that they still are talking about, the manufactured crisis, is this concept that the election was stolen. Mm-hmm. And they keep harping.
I think that this story for me, because Christopher Miller testified a while ago, but I think these authors of this piece have really put it in stark clarity, just how close we were to a coup and sort of like lacing everything together, kind of weaving the narrative. And one thing that I didn't know, one, that Christopher Miller was supposed to be a loyalist, right? He was supposed to actually support whatever Trump wanted to do. And instead, he was the last line of defense against his worst impulses. So if it hadn't been Miller, if he had just promoted anyone random, or in fact, the Pentagon went through a major shift in those months leading up to January 6th. So like everything was set, the stage was set. Trump was just banking on the fact that Miller would call out the National Guard, but they would be in support of his people. In fact, I think that's what the plan was. Instead, and this is Christopher Miller, he testified, he says plainly, there was absolutely no way I was putting US military forces at the Capitol, period. Now, as someone who's been in a lot of protests, who's been prevented from entering buildings peacefully, there are ways to put more defense mechanisms in front of the Capitol building that aren't the National Guard. Like, you could have multiple barricades, you can have like, you know, riot cops, you can have, you know, bike cops. They love their bike. They love that netting. My God. That being said, I've never actually charged police in battle gear and like bear mace and pitchforks, you know what I mean? And American flags, using them as weapons. So I don't know, you know what I mean? I'm ignorant, I guess, of really what it takes. But, you know, and I think that Brett, you're right. Like this is the entire point is actually the lesson that a lot of these fascists are taking is, clean house earlier and make sure you get someone like Christopher Miller on your side. Make sure the Secretary of Defense is with you, and make sure all the generals, the ones who quote unquote misbehave, they're purged.
And there's proof of it. Like you hear Donald Trump afterwards, like very soon after the beginning of his presidency, going, I shouldn't have gone with someone who would recuse themselves as attorney general.
Yes.
Like I should never have done that. I should have gone with a loyalist. I thought I could have it both ways. I thought this guy was a big enough sycophant, but he just wasn't a psychopath. Mm-hmm. That's a problem.
All right, let's take our first break without Juan. But you see me, we'll see you in a second.
There it is.
What's up, you guys? Welcome back to the Damage Report. Francesca Fiorentini and Brett Ehrlich with you all on a Christmas Eve, just two Eves, I think. We got more news, of course, big stuff. So President Joe Biden has given us a little stocking stuffer this Christmas, extending the pause on student loans until May 1st. So that's good, I think. A little bit more time. The payments were set to restart in February, if you guys remember. But now we have until May to convince him to just cancel it, because nothing is going to happen between now and May when it comes to convincing Joe Manchin to do literally anything. So just cancel student loan debt. Just 10, 15, 50,000. How about all of it? But in case you guys needed a little refresher, for those of you who are or are not mired in these debts, 43.2 million student borrowers in the United States, averaging $39,351 each. The outstanding federal loan portfolio is over $1.59 trillion. And you could see, let's just go to this graph of debt. I mean, compared to credit card debt, home equity debt, obviously it's like, how the hell are we gonna have home equity loans if we can't pay off our student loans? Let's, you know, put the cart in front of the horse here, people. But by far, the sources of debt among borrowers is student loans, the highest source of debt. So given all that, President Biden woke up a little bit, not extending this the child tax credits, but the student loan pauses. So he said, given these considerations, today my administration is extending the pause on federal student loan repayments for an additional 90 days through May 1st, 2022, as we manage the ongoing pandemic and further strengthen our economic recovery. Yes, borrower balances have effectively been frozen for more than a year. So no payments required on federal loans since March 2020. And the interest has stopped adding up, which is really important. That's unlike a lot of eviction moratoriums and rental deferments. Saving the average borrower about $2,000 over the first year, and collections on defaulted debt have also been on hold. So, I mean, this is the difference between people keeping their homes, being able to feed their families, and not being able to plan for the future and not. But it's very far from what he said during campaign Biden, right? Okay, so campaign Biden, a lot of people are like, he promised to cancel student debt. He did actually promise to cancel student debt. He didn't promise to cancel all of it, but this is him on the campaign trail, speaking to a young former student who is strapped with debt. He said to this person, I'm gonna eliminate your student debt if you come from a family making less than $125,000 and went to a public university. Biden also said, I'm going to make sure everyone gets $10,000 knocked off their student debt in response to economic hardships caused by the pandemic. So, okay, the average borrower saved $2,000. So we've got five more years to get to that point where you knock off $10,000. I don't know. Like, there's a lot to be done, Joe, but it is progress. Brett, your response.
There's a lot of different ways to look at debt. And when you're chucking numbers around, the amount of debt you forgive is actually corresponds to a much larger amount of money that you would end up having to have paid. So if you take a student, if you have interest on any debt, let's say I take out $100,000, whatever my interest rate is, it's not that I just pay that plus my interest rate of 17%, depending on what kind of loan you have, 6%, 2%, whatever, what kind of payment you have to do. That compounds every year. So if you forgive $10,000 of student loan debt, you could be, depending on how long your payment schedule is, you could save that person $20,000 over the course of them having to pay it back. Now, when you pause that, those people are just not paying $2,000 now. You're not taking away from the amount they're going to have to repay back because you're not forgiving any of it.
Right.
So this is just kind of kicking the can down the road, which is something that, like, when we talk about putting awesome new government programs in place, the reason people fight against that is because people realize, like Medicare, it's better than private insurance for all its flaws. You're gonna have, you know, it becomes a third rail of politics. So Social Security is the original third rail of politics. People like it. You talk about getting rid of it, Republican, Democrat, whoever it is, you lose massive amount of votes. So that's why they don't want to put them in place. But the way that the government can get into kind of not suffering the backlash from their donors of forgiving the debt is to do this. Kick the can down the road 5 months at a time. Now, yeah, that creates uncertainty that ends up also tanking the financial market. That dynamic is also at play when it comes to the debt ceiling, when it comes to the federal budget, when they do these continuing resolutions to fund the government. instead of like an omnibus bill that would go for a year, 2 years, 10 years. They can do that, but they are such political wuss bags and that they don't realize the positive feedback they'd get by forgiving student loan debt, which Francesca just proved affects a ton of people. They think that getting that support from a ton of people is not as politically beneficial to counteract losing the support of their donors, who are frequently, especially in Joe Biden's case, Chris Coons' case, and the other Democratic senator in a state that prides itself on no corporate tax. Like, you would alienate a ton of people who are your political donors.
Yeah, and it doesn't, here's my thing with eliminating student debt though. Like, I do think they're gonna alienate some political donors, but like, this is all federally held debt. So, and you don't hear Republicans railing like, how dare he blah, blah. I mean, they would if he did anything, but you don't hear about like the big, you know, federal student debt lobby that wants to continue having Americans pay, you know, pay and pay and pay and pay. And like, it's like, it is kind of politically a win for him in my book. I mean, it definitely would do huge, it would be incredible for his numbers and his approval rating, especially for people who voted for him, maybe holding their nose thinking that, especially young folks who are like generally skew progressive, are maybe were Bernie voters. This is a way to get them back. So on a political level, I think it makes sense. He has canceled $1.5 billion in debt, but those were only for those who were defrauded by for-profit colleges. So already there was a lot involved in that. There was, he promised, look, public universities, that's where I'm knocking off the debt, and he hasn't yet done it. I think this is good to delay it. I just think they need to go farther. But there was more this week out of Biden, number of things, including testing for COVID and thoughts about a future election run and against whom. Joe Biden did set, let me just hang on, it's for the clip. Joe Biden sat down with an ABC reporter and discussed a number of issues, including the number of tests that are currently supposedly on order, and also whether he would run for re-election and against who. So let's go to what he said about ordering these new tests, 500 million of them promised, and why he didn't do it sooner.
If you go to the pharmacy, we hear this over and over again, empty shelves, no test kits. Is that a failure?
No, I don't think it's a failure. I think it's, you could argue that we should have known a year ago, 6 months ago, 2 months ago, a month ago. I've ordered 500 million of the pills, 500 million pills. I mean, excuse me, 500 million test kits that are gonna be available to be sent to every home in America if anybody wants them. But the answer is, yeah, I wish I had thought about ordering 500 million pills 2 months ago before COVID hit here.
Okay, so let's just ignore the fact that he misspoke and said pills, but he meant tests, and then he misspoke again by saying pills, but he really meant tests. Like, I just sort of let that part of Biden wash over me, and you know,
the sitting pain face when he's listening, his like listening face is, I don't know, there's lights. Okay, now put on the smile.
I mean, I understand. It's been the winter solstice, it's dark out, but like, I feel like, you know, they just didn't catch him. This interview with David Muir didn't happen at the best time. But yes. So he says, I wish we would have known. Man, I wish we would have known that COVID was still going to be a thing and we needed tests. Do we buy that, Brett?
I think, yeah, I don't know with the Biden administration. That's what's so frustrating. It is a Rorschach test of your, you know, cynicism. And none of the result, no one's seeing a beautiful flower, you know, like everybody's seeing either wanton corruption of a guy who pretends he's dumb stumbling for the people, and just haplessly can't get Biden to come along because, or can't get Manchin to come along because he just assumed that there was some loyalty there that there wasn't. So he's either, you know, incompetent or evil is really what you look at. I would say that this came from a specific question asked to Jen Psaki that she laughed off, but realized someone came up and was like, wait, why can't we do that?
Yeah. The entire internet rose up and everyone was like, this was bad. This was a bad look. I don't know if she had just come off from answering like a right winger's question or like she was in sarcasm mode, but being like, oh, what are we gonna do? Send a bunch of tests to every American? Yeah. Many countries do that for a very affordable price. And so now the Biden administration is reversing course. So this is from Jen Psaki saying 500 million tests in January is the largest order we have made to date. And we're gonna do it as quickly as we can, but they won't be available until January. So this was earlier this week. And as of now, no progress has been made. Look, I get it. It's the holidays. You gotta make your cocktails and entertain people. But you're also in the White House and there's a pandemic and a new variant that's come out. So according to Insider, President Biden's administration is yet to sign contracts to buy the 500 million COVID-19 tests that the White House promised earlier this week. So we'll get to it later. I mean, it's coming. Anyway. Ooh, what's for dinner?
Yeah, it's just right. And just to more crystallize it, there was a moment in the press briefing where someone asked, why can't you freaking, you know, give people money? She was like, that would be hilarious. And oh my God, I guess they have a sense of humor now because they're doing it. And they're still like, it seems like since they haven't ordered them yet, it feels like they just did it for the yucks. Like just, it was just a joke. Like just hit, you know, we've all done that when we're shopping for Christmas presents and we put something in the cart and we forget to check out. And then you're like, why hasn't that arrived yet? You check back in. It's like, oh, this won't show up till after Christmas because I just didn't hit, you know, buy it now. Buy it now.
Just buy it now, Biden.
Biden it now.
Yeah, Biden it now. I mean, obviously boycott Amazon, but buy it now. No, I mean, I think to me also, it's the idea that they didn't see this coming. In a different part of that same interview, he said, you know, I wish we would have thought of this sooner, which we just saw, but also who could have seen Omicron coming? I don't know, cause it's O and there's a lot of letters of the Greek alphabet before it. And you came into the presidency under Delta or right before Delta hit. Like your whole rollout for your vaccine, which Biden has been upholding as like the silver bullet, right? That was put on the back burner. Remember the July 4th, we're all gonna have hot dogs and, you know, talk about the old times together and whatever. That was put on the back burner because of Delta. So the idea that they didn't see this coming, and like, I don't wanna go into the amount of like fraud and faulty testing and just like the knot that has to be untied after all this is over is insane. The amount of money that has been wasted in from city and states into bad testing equipment, into, you know, like crappy, just stuff that is giving false negatives, stuff like that. It's a lot. So to say that you didn't know this was coming is, I think it's just irresponsible. It shows a lot of lack of accountability when you're in the middle of a pandemic, man. Of course you should see this coming. If nothing else, we'll have more tests. That's not a bad thing. And right now what's happening, and we don't have graphics for this, but Bill de Blasio, right, mayor of New York, has been begging, in fact, the federal government for more assistance because we've seen the lines wrapping around blocks in New York City, people getting tested, waiting hours and hours to be tested, if at all. And he's asking, you know, to mobilize the Defense Production Act, which has not been mobilized yet, by the way, not mobilized under Biden. Anthony Fauci says that's because they've got enough money, they're producing it in other ways, they're, you know, but it still hasn't been ordered.
And there's a win. There's a very clear win out here. It is the all-in-one, you know, prevention, you know, ounce of prevention, pound of cure, Biden beginning to end plan, which is,
yeah,
we have, you know, done everything in terms of encouraging people to get vaccinated. We had the entire, all three Jonas brothers help us do that. And then we have this pill that he's talking about where the FDA approved the Pfizer pill to help drastically reduce hospitalizations that addresses the early prevention, the early treatment, things that such cutting edge doctors as Joe Rogan have encouraged. But the missing piece is fast testing so that we can, you know, we hear you. We know we need to be able to find out if people have this disease. We need to know it fast. So now we have, you know, bridged the gap with the testing. That's why he said pill. We need to have the prevention of the vaccine, the testing to find out if you have it, and the pill if you are diagnosed with a positive to treat it. And that is the, you know, full regimen of prescriptions from the Biden administration.
Which is progress, I guess. But order those tests, buddy. Quickly, I want to move on. So in this same interview with David Muir, Joe Biden was asked whether he would run for re-election and also whether he would run against a certain former president who has said that he does not like to talk about. Take a look.
I want to ask you about something I asked weeks before the election when we sat down. You said you would absolutely serve 8 years if elected. Do you plan to run for re-election?
Yes, but look, I'm a great respecter of fate. Fate has intervened in my life many, many times. If I'm in the health I'm in now, if I'm in good health, then in fact, I would run again.
And if that means a rematch against Donald Trump?
You're trying to tempt me now. Sure. Why would I not run against Donald Trump for even the nominee? That would increase the prospect of running.
That would increase the prospect of running. Okay, Joe Biden believes in fate, but also kind of cocky against Donald Trump. I did it once, could do it again. Can you though? Brett?
If he does it, he's gonna have to pass some voting rights legislation, buddy. I hate to break it to you because it's not just going up against that team you went up against last week and won. You have now allowed time for that other team to rewrite the rules of the game you're playing in the meantime. So if the difference in all those states, no matter how big your electoral victory was, if the difference between your loss and victory last time was a Secretary of State saying that Donald Trump's squad didn't cheat soon enough, you've given them 4 years to cheat very, very in a widespread manner, very meticulously. So people like Raffensperger don't say, well, sorry, you're against the rules. So it is an insane thing to think that he can just go back up against Donald Trump when you have that anti-incumbent bias during a pandemic and new rules of electoral politics and the electoral system in the states you barely won.
That is a really important point, the anti-incumbent bias during COVID. I mean, politicians the world over are not surviving this. And I think a lot of folks, including myself, think that Trump would have been reelected had it not been for the pandemic and had he not completely bungled it. And yes, he does have blood on his hands. I think it is interesting to hear Biden talk about fate. Like, look, I appreciate Joe Biden for being human. I don't always appreciate that coming from the Oval Office. I don't love to hear the idea of like, if Joe Biden loses or if he's too sick, that's fate. You know, if we don't pass voting rights and I don't, you know, amend the filibuster and change the rules, you know, that's just fate. You know, if like hundreds of thousands of black voters are purged from rolls, maybe that's just fate. Like, does not instill confidence. Which is something that, once again, this president is not really good at doing. All right, why don't we take our second break? Yes?
I'm down.
No?
Yeah, let's do it. This is a good time for it.
Thus is good. All right, stay right there. All right, you guys, welcome back to the Damage Report. For Jessica Fiorentini, Brett Ehrlich, we got more stories. This one, to be expected, a little sad, but important. Many families are planning on what they're gonna eat for Christmas dinner, for New Year's, but millions of families in America are actually wondering if there's going to be enough to eat. In fact, new Census Bureau data estimates that more than 21 million Americans did not have enough to eat in early December as pandemic relief payments dried up and grocery store prices have risen. So the number of households in which there were sometimes or often not enough to eat reached between 9.7% this month, a 5-month high, which says a lot for a pandemic that's supposedly at the tail end, maybe not. According to data collected between December 1st and 13th by the US Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, that figure in households with children sunk from 11% to 7.8% in August after the first child tax credit monthly payments went out. Maybe there's a correlation. Grocery store prices, of course, in the US are up 6.4% from a year earlier. Food banks are also seeing a rise in demand, and clinics meant to help malnourished and underfed children have seen an increase in patients. So I think a lot of us, especially last year, these are the dark days of the pandemic. I think that food banks were wonderfully paid a lot of attention to. There was a lot of, they were collecting a lot of donations. And yet a year later, when there is no more stimulus checks and this child tax credit, yes, has run out. In fact, we might be in a darker and more difficult place than we were a year ago when it comes to families being fed. Any reactions to that wonderful bit of holiday news, Brett?
I know, it's like, I thought this was a Christmas party, and no, it's sad. I will say that there's a lot of, I don't know, we have a big opportunity in the wake of crises like this to continue the things we learned from them, or out of this weird psychological feeling of necessity, go back to the way it was beforehand, because this was just too hard. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of initiatives put into place during the Great Depression that, in that era that still live on to today, augmented in the 60s and in early 70s. And we have an opportunity to do both or neither, or to do either one of those. And yeah. Hopefully we take advantage and learn from what we learned to take care of people who are less fortunate and going through harder stuff. But it just, the incessant attempt to politicize every aspect of the pandemic and the response to it might result in us just going back to normal and saying, you know what, screw the poor.
I mean, and it's incredible since Biden ran on, especially towards the end there, maybe to lure Bernie voters over, maybe because he read the room and understood that this was his FDR, LBJ, Great Society moment, that he wanted to be the most progressive president since FDR, that he wanted to embark on these kinds of plans. And this was obviously the week where Joe Manchin very simply and easily and predictably put a wrench in all of those plans. And it doesn't look like Biden has a fallback at this point to actually make good on that legacy or what he wanted to be his legacy. So more on the child tax credit. Again, there's been no extension of it. And just to refresh, the credit is in advance for, let's go to this. That's not a graphic, but look at this. So this is where people spent money on the child tax credit. Did it all go to Christmas presents? Did it all go to Minecraft? No, it went 59% of parents use the advance payments for food. Second runner up, utilities, rent and mortgage, clothing, education costs. So this is, it's very, very clear what people need this money for and why. We talked about debt a little bit earlier and how many people hold it. Sadly, in fact, a lot of people are using their child tax credits to pay off their debt. So for the majority of households making less than $50,000 a year, they're putting those payments towards their debt. An August survey by the Census Bureau found, and higher income families, no surprise, were more likely to be saving the money. Another report from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities found 91% of households making less than $35,000 a year use the money to pay for food, shelter, clothing, and other necessities. And Black and Hispanic families were more likely to use their credits on education-related costs, such as school supplies. I mean, and especially when schools have been closed up until a few months ago. So imagining, now I have to turn my home into a straight up learning environment in addition to putting food on the table. So just if there was any question, right, why we shouldn't means test this, whether or not child tax credits even work or not, this is from Columbia University right after, or who found out that making payments permanent, which is what the Build Back Better Act would extend them greatly, could reduce child poverty in the United States by 40%. And as proof of that, after credits went out in July, food insecurity in households with kids dropped from 11% to 8.4%. And we just went over the how that's now flipping. So this is something that Joe Manchin wants to put in work requirements. One pretty amazing thing about these child tax credits was that you actually don't need to have a job. And so many people have been without work in order to receive them. So yes, once again, proof, these things are popular, they work. Why are we letting them dry up?
Yes, there is. People are saying that America has never been more divided. I can point at a handful of polls that show you that America has never been more united. But the things that each political party seeks to use to stay in power are the things that are dividing us. Mm-hmm. They would rather talk about critical race theory, which has no bearing on anyone's life. And oh my God, let's go to a school board meeting. That's how we help parents. No, this is a tax cut for parents. This is money. This is a tax cut. This is a child tax credit. They give you credit. This is a tax cut. And Republicans are not behind it.
100%.
That's all you need to know. There are two huge wins on the table for anyone who wants to scoop them up. Downside is you might have to part with some of your support from political donors. The first one is this, all right? The second one is Medicare drug price negotiations. Without that Medicare drug price negotiation, it is a tax on grandma and grandpa.
Yeah.
You're taxing them. You're making them and me and you, because it's a government program. Those folks who are against negotiating Medicare drug prices are for keeping taxes higher. Because the tax money goes into Medicare and we are spending twice as much as every other developed nation on healthcare. It's more efficient there, but it's still inefficient because there's millions of people.
I want to quickly see if we can squeeze in this final story because everyone's got to see it. Linear, I don't care where you are. Let's jump into this next clip.
I stand on, forget about the mandates that people have to have their freedom. But at the same time, the vaccine is one of the greatest achievements of mankind. We would have had a 1917, remember the Spanish flu, killed perhaps 100 million people. Actually, it ended the First World War because the soldiers were so, a lot of people don't know that. The soldiers got so sick. It was a terrible thing. There were no vaccines, there were no anything. I came up with a vaccine, with three vaccines. Mm. All are very, very good. Came up with three of them in less than 9 months. It was supposed to take 5 to 12 years.
And yet more people have died under COVID this year, by the way, under Joe Biden, than under you. And more people took the vaccine this year. So people are questioning how—
Well, no, the vaccine worked, but some people aren't taking it. The ones that get very sick and go to the hospital are the ones that don't take the vaccine. But it's still their choice. And if you take the vaccine, you're protected. Look, the results of the vaccine are very good. And if you do get it, it's a very minor form. People aren't dying when they take the vaccine.
What about the masking of children?
What about something that I can actually agree on? Because you're making way too much sense, former president and savior. That was Donald Trump speaking to Candace Owens on her Daily Wire podcast. And that was the president, the former president, speaking scientific sense for the first time, because once again, he's now on a pro-vaccine kick and is mad at people, his supporters, who are against that. And there he's saying, if you take this vaccine, if you get boosted, the likelihood you're going to be hospitalized is greatly reduced. Then he also said, I did that. I made three vaccines, which it's like, I don't know, give it to him, Brett.
Yeah, I'm with it. Like Donald Trump, he can very easily scoop up a bunch of support by coming out against the vaccines. The downside is he feels this need to take credit for stuff and he wants credit for how fast the vaccines were developed. I'm with you, give him credit, take credit, I don't care.
Yeah, 30 years in the making, sure dude. In a month, that was all you, bro. Like,
That was a right boss moment. We're gonna do this, right, boss? Is Candace Owens right, boss? That's what we're gonna do, boss. And boss is like, shut up, get that guy out of here, get Candace Owens out of here. And she's like, but what about me, boss? He's like, all right, masks, fine.
What about masking children? And she interrupts him multiple times in that. All right, we got to wrap right now. Brett Ehrlich, Francesca Fiorentini, we got more show on YouTube. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.